Today is November 29th, and we're still studying Providence and Theodicy in post-Holocaust literature. We finished Professor Eliza Berkowitz and Faith After the Holocaust. Now we're beginning Breaking the Tablets by Dr. Rabbi David Weiss Halivni. And we're going to spend only one or two classes on this book, and then we'll go on to Yitz Greenberg, Dr. Rabbi Yitz Greenberg. Very short amount of introduction to David Weiss Halivni. I know him personally. I heard a few lectures from him in the past. I had the merit of sitting with him at a wedding a few years ago, so I got to know him a little bit. He is today considered to be the greatest living Talmud scholar in the world. When I say Talmud scholar, I don't mean Talmid Chacham in the traditional sense. In the Haredi world, there might be, I don't know, there might be individuals, rabbis, who know more of the Talmudic literature than he does, but as far as the modern world, or the academic world, he's considered to be the, by far, the greatest living Talmudic scholar. And he really does know everything. You know those stories they tell about putting a pin through a volume of the Talmud, and someone could tell you every word that the pin passes through on each double-sided page. He's really one of those. Wow. He really is one of those. But he's also a nice guy. He was born in 1927, which means that when the Holocaust reached his hometown in Transylvania, Czechoslovakia, Poland, it changes all the time, and he was 16. And he spent 2 years in the camps. He went through the Holocaust for real. His whole family was lost. And by the way, Elie Wiesel and him are from the same hometown, Signet, if I'm pronouncing it. They actually knew each other, and they continue to be colleagues to this very day. It's unbelievable. So he spent 2 years in the camps, and he made it out at the age of 18 and immediately found himself in America. And then he began his career. He spent most of his life at JTS, the Jewish Theological Seminary, and at Columbia. He also founded a rabbinical seminary, and he moved to Israel, made Aliyah. This goes back, I think, 10 years ago. He's been a little bit at Hebrew University. But he's still writing a monumental commentary on the Talmud. I have at home, I think, 5 volumes of it. He's not halfway through, but we'll see how far he gets, and we'll hope that he gets all the way through. He's written a number of books. Besides his Talmudic commentary, this is his autobiography. I just thought I'd show it to you, The Book and the Sword. It's one of that genre of Holocaust memoirs. And if it's not the most earth-shattering book in the world, but for those people who know him through his academic and religious writings, so it's nice to know the person behind the writings, The Book and the Sword. So we're going to approach this book, Breaking the Tablets. It's really a collection of different essays that he wrote, put together by a student of his, Peter Ox, and there's an epilogue written by David Weiss Halivni. So here we go. We have the material, and we're going to read just a little bit, really. Since we've already read Faith After the Holocaust, this will be easy because we have now the building blocks to fit it into, and at every stage we can compare between what he writes, David Weiss Halivni, and what Professor Eliezer Berkowitz writes. So here we go. So according to the little marks and arrows that I wrote into the text that I photocopied, this is page 17. Right? That's the way I began there, page 17. We're going to read a little bit less than my arrows and my marks say. I decided yesterday to read even less. This essay, the first essay of the book, is called Prayer in the Shoah. It was written as an introduction to a Sidur that was a Machzor that was published by Yad Vashem. What happened is there was a Machzor written in the camps by a Holocaust victim, an inmate, by memory. Wrote it on the scraps of cement bags and little piece of paper. They wrote a whole machzor so they'd have it for the high holidays. And that machzor was put out by Yad Vashem a decade ago. And this essay was written as an introduction to that publication of the machzor. And again, we're reading bits and pieces. So page 17, where my bracket is on the right-hand side. To understand the full meaning of this prayer, we must first reflect deeply on the question that grounds all Halakha's theology. Page 17 at the top. The one I gave out last time.
Oh, okay.
To understand the full meaning of this prayer, we must first reflect deeply on the question that grounds all Halakha's theology. Do we attribute the Shoah to sin? Lest there be any doubt about my own response to the question, I will state my conclusions at the outset. It is written in the Torah, a second time in the prophets, a third time in the writings, and a fourth time in the words of the sages, that the Shoah was not the consequence of sin. And he says what he says in that kind of poetic language. That's a paraphrase from a statement in the Talmud. He's putting in a different context. But when we want to say something is really certain, we say it's written in the Torah, it's written in the prophets, it's written in the Nevi'im. In the Ketuvim, excuse me. And yet for all that, when they're in the land of their enemies, I will not cast them away, nor will I loathe them to destroy them and utterly and to break my covenant with them, a quote from Leviticus. And that comes in the context of a list of the brachan kala, the blessing for keeping the mitzvot and the curse for not observing. So God says with all the punishment, and there's a long list of punishment there, all the terrible things that happened to the Jewish people, but God says, I will not destroy them utterly. After the Torah warns the children of Israel that if they sin, they will be driven out of their land and suffer a disease, war, and famine to the point of eating human flesh, it closes with the assurance that despite their sins, God will not despise or reject them or annihilate them. And this is annihilate. This was written in Hebrew. Professor Halivni wrote it in Hebrew. And the translator puts there in brackets, in parentheses, what the original Hebrew said, Yaviotam lekilayon. I will not abrogate the covenant that he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. According to the covenant made between God and them, they would not be destroyed for their sins. In other words, he sees here, and that's really the pshat, that's the simple meaning of the verse in the Torah, that with all the punishment that will come upon the Jewish people for sin, that punishment will never bring the Jewish people to annihilation. I said it right?
Annihilation.
Will never bring the Jewish people to annihilation. And what he's about to say in the next 10 pages is that since the Shoah brought the Jewish people of Europe to absolute annihilation, therefore can't be punishment for sin. Because God's promise was punishment for sin will never bring the Jewish people to annihilation. And since that was annihilation what happened, he went through it and he tells you there was nothing left of the people and the institutions of Eastern Europe. That was annihilation and therefore it couldn't have been punishment for sin. That's going to be his whole point for the next 20 pages. 10, 20 pages. We're going to read only a tiny, tiny, tiny piece of it. What does the word lekalotam, annihilate them, mean? Should we understand this in the quantitative or qualitative sense? That's what God said he won't do as punishment for sin. Does it mean he will not completely destroy them to the point that not even a survivor or refugee is left, or that he will not destroy to such an extent that they cannot rebuild their lives? What's the meaning of annihilation? Those who claim that the Shoah is a result of sin will interpret lekalotam quantitatively as total annihilation, total extermination. From this perspective, if any survivor remained then, even though most of the population was destroyed, this would not count as total annihilation and would not therefore weaken God's promise to Israel. It would not be a contradiction of the promise, he means. These interpreters believe that since there were survivors who rebuilt their lives, and also contributed to an enhancement of Judaism, even though very few Jews from Eastern Europe survived, a small part of the promise must have been kept. In this view, those who were destroyed were punished for their sins. These interpreters therefore believe that the Shoah was a consequence of sin. This interpretation is incorrect and misguided. Lekalotam does not mean total extermination, the killing of a people, a large part of it, but rather the irremediable destruction of a people's institutional infrastructure. And this is precisely what happened in the Shoah. Institutional Jewish life in East of Europe was uprooted and almost totally erased. The only survivors were as brands snatched from the fire. The limits of lo lekalotam, not to annihilate them, were blurred and suspended, and the covenant God made with Israel was shaken, if not totally abrogated. We cannot therefore attribute the Shoah to sin. God promised not to destroy Israel for their sins, and there's no greater destruction in history than the Shoah. He went through it. And he, again and again throughout this book, says that the Shoah was sui generis. There was nothing that ever happened like it in Jewish history at all. All of the persecution we went through, you might be able to interpret it as punishment for sin, because it wasn't total annihilation. But this was total annihilation. The institutions of European Jewry are gone, and it's impossible to resurrect them. There's nothing left. Anything that will be rebuilt in Israel or in America is something else. It's not the same thing. What was there is gone. And since that total annihilation, and the verse says God will never, as a punishment for sin, annihilate, therefore it must have been something else. It must have been something much, much bigger than God punishing people for their sins.
That seems to be somewhat of a circular argument. Statement that God will not, circular arguments are used, is probably the wrong way. And God said that he would never,
as punishment for sin.
As punishment for sin. Well, you know, that starts opening up all kinds of questions about what sin is and everything like that. And it certainly does limit. I think it's giving a very narrow interpretation of what God said.
I'm not sure why you're saying that. Then let me just say it differently. God said he won't annihilate the Jewish people. In the Shoah, the Jewish people were annihilated. Therefore, it wasn't from God. That's what he's saying. But take the word sin out of it, you can. It wasn't from God, because it contradicts the verses, he says.
Okay. Wasn't there, in the destruction of the Second Temple, wasn't there a complete institutional infrastructure annihilation?
He says no.
He says no, but I'm questioning it. No longer the temple, no longer. It was.
This book goes through that.
Yeah.
And he claims that Jewish life continued more or less as it had been after the temple, as it was before the temple. There was a small minority of people involved in the temple service, the Kohanim, the Levim, but the basic institutions of the Jewish people, which already had been established before the destruction of the Second Temple as synagogue worship and as study, that continued. He says that there wasn't the break at all. There wasn't the break that there was with the Shoah. Those people who were exiled at the Second Temple period continued living their Jewish life in exile as they had before the exile. The institutions continued to exist.
Yeah.
Think of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was exiled from Jerusalem to Yavne, but it continued to function. Not to make light, of course, of the terrible destruction of the Second Temple, but it was nothing, he says, compared to what the Shoah did.
Well, he's defining, yeah. I'll let him make the point then.
Okay.
But I don't agree with him. Forgetting whether or not the Shoah had anything to do with sin, I don't think that Jewish life necessarily, as it was, it no longer may have existed in the place where he grew up, but it existed the same way.
It existed elsewhere, existed in America, and existed in Israel.
They still followed the Torah, they still had synagogues, they just moved.
Remember that
at
the outset of the war, 1939-1940, the vast, vast, vast majority of institutions of Jewish life were in Eastern Europe. The institutions, the traditions that had grown
90%.
Up over hundreds of years. Right? In America, there was nothing. America was a wasteland then as far as institutions of traditional Jewish life.
With that.
Okay.
I grew up during that period. We had temples in the United States. We had schools.
But it was nothing compared.
But the bottom line was in Europe. It didn't go away just because of what happened in Nazi Germany. It moved.
No. What was in Nazi Germany disappeared. It didn't move to a different country. What was founded in different countries after was something else. The institutions were gone.
People moved. People left Germany before the war. People left France before the war. Those people went to either Israel.
Yeah, the people went. A few people went.
And they took all their culture with them.
No. There was such a major destruction that the institution...
Well, that's his opinion.
Okay, you know what? So that's really not important. Let's not make the point.
But it's the point that he's trying to build his whole hypothesis on. And
you know, I would say you could read the book if you want, mm-hmm. but it's not that important for the theological issue. He thinks it's important, but we could let him make his point irrespective.
But we're talking about a few of the yeshivas were saved with their people.
Almost nothing. Almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the Mir yeshiva made it through Shanghai, mm-hmm. etc.
Right.
The Hebron yeshiva had been uprooted already in the 1920s.
What I don't like is the word sin filling any of them.
Say it again, please.
The word sin, I find that grotesque, that I will just, you know, annihilate you because of sin or not.
Well, that's what he's saying. He agrees with you.
But the whole word sin, we don't sin.
What do you mean you don't sin?
As a people. I mean, it's like being threatened by your parents. If you do something wrong, I'm going to annihilate you. If you don't, I won't annihilate you. But the threat is there.
The threat is there, just like if you go through a red light, you'll pay a fine. It's the same thing.
But it's not annihilation.
There's capital punishment for murder. But again, let's go back to the reading. We're in the paragraph that begins, "As for the kinds of destruction." As for the kinds of destruction that God might bring as a punishment for sin, this could result in the peoples being exiled to a foreign land, as characterized in the first rebuke in Parshat Bechukotai at the end of Leviticus, or this kind of destruction could result in the peoples being conquered while in their own land, as characterized in the second rebuke in Parshat Ki Tavo at the end of Deuteronomy. In both cases, individuals die from disease, war, famine, and other causes. But he says that's not what happened to Shoah. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Can you join everybody?
You can. You'd have to look on with someone with the text. We're reading in modern Jewish philosophy.
Okay. I'll just hear.
We must bear in mind
Thank you.
That the relationship between destruction and sin is different from the relationship between exile and sin. Again, exile and sin, that exists. But destruction and sin doesn't exist.
So he's upholding the prayer.
He's willing to uphold Mipnei Chataeinu, which Professor Eliezer Berkovitz wasn't. On several occasions, the Torah takes note of the relationship between exile and sin and even offers the following reason for it. The people who first inhabited the land, right, the Canaanites, were expelled and killed because of their abominations. The Torah was therefore concerned to specify what these abominations were in minute detail, so the children of Israel would be clearly warned. If they too turned towards these abominations, they would have no more right than their predecessors to remain in the land. Like the first inhabited, they too would be expelled. In language of the Torah, the country will vomit them out. Another quote, "Do not defile yourselves in any of these ways, so that the land will not vomit you out in the way to vomit out the nation that came before you." Leviticus. There is therefore legal justification for the belief that we're exiled from our land on account of our sins. In general. And he upholds that throughout Jewish history, except for the Shoah. But there is no justification for relating annihilation to sin. The Holy One promised Israel that even if they were in their land of their enemies, he would not annihilate them or destroy their capacities to reorganize their lives and return to their land. When their land was conquered, he promised to remove the yoke of the nations from their necks so that they might reestablish themselves. In our own age, most of the edifice of Judaism has been destroyed beyond repair by the cruelest actions in human history. We must not blame such a catastrophe on the sins of its victims. Anyone who does so denies the promises God made to Israel and merits our careful scrutiny. In other words, he is basically saying that anyone who says that the Shoah was punishment for sin is a heretic. That's what it means. It merits our careful scrutiny. He is very, very, not just rationally and textually involved in this, he is, of course, very, very emotionally involved in this. As an 18-year-old, he escaped from the Holocaust, from the clutches of Hitler. He comes to America, and he finds himself in one of the greatest yeshivot in America of that time. We're talking about 1945. And he looks at the yeshiva, he tells about the story in his book. The mashkiach, the kashrut supervisor of the yeshiva, didn't have a beard. So Professor Livni, as an 18-year-old, starts testing the mashkiach how much he knows halakha. And he finds that the guy, compared to Professor Livni, the 18-year-old genius, the guy is a relative ignoramus. He only knows 90% of the corpus of Jewish literature.
Only 90.
And that's part of his experience. He comes to America, there's nothing in this country, it doesn't compare to the institutions of Jewish life that existed in Europe. It's just, it's a wasteland. That's part of his experience.
Excuse me, where did he teach in Israel, you said?
In Israel, he made it to Israel only in his 70s.
Oh.
He taught at Hebrew University.
Hebrew U.
He was in the Institute for Advanced Studies on Givat Ram. I used to go and listen to his lectures in the 1990s. So we're going to skip now, skipping page 19 and going to page 20. We're only going to read half of page 20. I'm only going to read half of page 20 from the middle. What happened in the Shoah? Do you see that? What happened in the Shoah is above and beyond measure, above and beyond suffering, above and beyond any punishment. There is no transgression that merits such punishment. There can't be anything you can do that would merit such a punishment. Such utter destruction has never transpired before in history, has never before been fashioned by Satan, and it cannot be attributed to sin. Whoever attributes the Shoah to sin denies the promise God made on two occasions to the prophet Jeremiah. With respect to you, the people Israel, I will not bring annihilation and will not utterly destroy. Just like the Torah says it, so Jeremiah also says it. Such a person, anyone who says the Shoah is punishment for sin, such a person not only accuses the sufferers slanderously with having caused their own suffering, but also indirectly belittles the guilt of the truly guilty by implying that they only did what they had to do, that they were God's instrument, and therefore they had to do it. If they didn't do it, someone else would do it. If not they, then some others would have had to do this. Such things must not be uttered. I cannot fail to take note of the texts that appear to contradict my claim that sin does not bring annihilation. Most texts that appear to contradict my reading of annihilation are easily reconciled by noting that in these texts, annihilation does not apply to all Israel, even most of Israel, but only to individuals and groups who are not included in the promise that God made not to annihilate. In other words, certainly the prophets say that God will annihilate certain individuals and even certain groups as a result of sin, but not the main body of the Jewish people. And that's what happened in the Shoah, according to Professor Livni. We're going to skip page 21 and skip 22 and 23. I think I photostated these pages for you, so you can look at them at home if you want. But we're going to skip them all. We're just going to read the bottom of 26 and the top of 27. And here he begins to hint at what his argument is going to be. The bottom of 26. Since the Shoah must not be seen as a consequence of sin, we conclude there remains an unsolved enigma. Whoever seeks to explain the Shoah reduces it to some natural phenomena, belittles its evil, and assuages the guilt of those who perpetrated it.
Assuages the guilt.
Assuages.
Yeah.
Thank you. Assuages the guilt of those who
perpetrated. Your kids from Brooklyn never learned proper English.
What happened is that when I went to high school, my high school wasn't on a very high level. Not at all. Everything I learned from reading books. And I never pronounced the words.
That's me. I had the same problem.
Remember, I didn't go to college except for 1 year. So I really never learned how people pronounce philosophic words or even medium level words.
I still have that problem sometimes.
I had a pronounced speech impediment. I didn't really talk until I was 20.
Goodness.
I was very, very long stuttering several times per sentence. I don't know many words how to pronounce them. I can read them. I've gone to college for 10 years.
So it's good just to read them. Nevertheless, we need to find an appropriate metaphor to express our understanding that the victims had no part in their own suffering and that nothing they had done or not done would have altered the constellation of their suffering. The Shoah came upon them as a result of cosmological forces that collided and struggled with each other.
What?
And thus struck the apple of the eye of history, the people of Israel. We turn to this theme in the second part of our discussion. If Stephanie said what, the word he used was cosmological forces that collided and struggled. Just listen, let him speak. Okay? But again, from the point of view of a victim of the Holocaust within the inferno of the camps, what's happening makes no sense. It can't be from God. It must be something greater than God, even greater than God, something God has no control over.
Oh, no.
So we're skipping now 27 and 28 and 29. We're going to read on page 31. See page 31?
You had something...
Yeah, I changed my mind.
Oh,
I'm making it even shorter than I planned.
Cosmologically speaking.
Cosmologically. we're now cosmologically speaking.
You're on page...
31.
Okay, this is not marked.
I marked it for now. I redid my marking.
Yeah,
page 31,
okay.
A Kabbalistic response.
He changed
okay.
his mind.
31.
All right, which paragraph?
You certainly have page 31 there, where it says a Kabbalistic response.
Okay.
A Kabbalistic response. Earlier, I rejected the notion that the Shoah is a consequence of sin, and I attributed instead to human evil, which reached its terrible apogee in our days. At the same time, I also recognize that this notion, he means punishment for sin, is comforting to Jews who believe that God intervenes in history for the good of Israel so long as the people's sins could not tip the scales of judgments against them. Right? People like to feel that God's in charge, and as long as it's not sin that he punishes, then they feel good to the feeling that there is hashkacha kalit. Remember that phrase? Hashkacha kalit, general divine providence. Since in our days the scales were certainly tipped against Israel, God did not in fact intervene. According to this reasoning, however, if the Shoah were not the result of sin, if God is involved and it's not the result of sin, then what? Then it would be difficult to explain why God was apparently indifferent in our days and chose not to intervene. Why, for example, did God intervene with the Egyptians, bring them plagues against the laws of nature, or in the time of Ahasuerus and Haman in a manner consistent with nature but not in Auschwitz? Why in Auschwitz did he lend human evil unlimited authority to destroy and be destroyed? Did God's promise to Jeremiah not obligate him, as it were, to intervene every time Israel was in danger of annihilation and to prevent it? Why did he not prevent the worst annihilation in human history? There is no answer. There's no answer. I sympathize with those who claim that in order for a person to achieve responsibility for his actions, he must first be fully free without any obstacles and external influences. To be sure, the knowledge of good and evil itself influences a person to choose the good, but when he chooses evil, he must, in order to merit punishment, have committed evil fully out of free choice without any external intervention. Any kind of intervention, even from God, reduces a person's responsibility for his actions. It is possible, therefore, that God will remain aloof in order to give human freedom. Where did we see this before?
That's
Berkowitz, right?
Berkowitz,
he says
yeah.
He has sympathy for Berkowitz's approach. Doesn't mention Berkowitz by name, but he has sympathy for that approach. But sympathy is not the same thing as fully identifying with it, as we're about to see. It is possible, therefore, that God will remain aloof in order not to diminish a person's freedom to act and thereby diminish his responsibility. God may stand apart, facing utter evil, without intervening and without responding. Something like this happened in the time of the Shoah. God did not intervene and did not respond, but stood apart. It sounds like Berkowitz. Similar, but we'll see the differences. The well-known homilies on the verse, quote, I am with him in suffering, from Psalms.
may have been offered in the spirit. The Holy One grieves for Israel's grief, but without putting an end to it, because he does not want to intervene in humanity's freedom to perform evil. But this homily is also applied when Israel suffers, because they have sinned and God has punished them. Thus, for example, in Midrash Lamentations, when they sinned and their enemies entered Jerusalem, the Holy One said, I wrote in the Torah, I am with him in suffering. But now that my children are overladen with suffering, shall I remain at ease? God grieves for the grief of Israel, even when Israel causes it. So God grieves for Israel when they suffer as divine punishment, and when they suffer and it's not divine punishment. When the Jewish people suffer, God grieves. Fine. And Professor Berkowitz said the same thing. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm sorry. I have signed copies of Rabbi Sachs' book, if anybody is interested in purchasing one.
Which raid?
Why?
Because we never got him to sign it last night.
Yes, you did.
No, we didn't.
Waited in line too long.
No, I got it from Mimi. Eileen gave it to Mimi.
So how much are the books?
The new book is 30, and then there were two others at 14 and 16. Anyway, does it? If anybody didn't get their book signed,
I got signed. Oh, one of those only for 14? How much is, which one is that?
Future Tense, I think,
okay,
is 14.
Okay, perhaps I'll come around.
Okay. All right, I'm sorry.
Okay.
All right.
In the next paragraph, I won't read it. He just says that he's not going to call God's refraining from intervening in order to provide human freedom. He's not going to call it hester panim,
hiding
of the face, because that's only applicable when God hides his face in punishment for sin. That, of course, is the opposite of what Berkowitz said. Berkowitz tried to prove that the phrase hester panim, hiding of the face, applies both as punishment for sin and both in general, when there's no punishment for sin. God just hiding his face in order to provide room for human responsibility. Berkowitz says, no, I'm sorry. Halithi says that the phrase applies only in place of sin. I'm not going to use it here, therefore he says. But that's not part of the essence of the argument. Let's now go to the paragraph, but the question still persists. Okay?
Where is that?
Just one paragraph down. Page 32, near the bottom.
Okay.
But the question still persists. Why, during our generation in particular, did God choose not to intervene, despite his having intervened in previous epochs to save Israel from annihilation?
Annihilation.
Why, in our generation in particular, did he choose not to interfere with the freedom and moral license of evildoers when he did interfere in previous times and even hardened Paro's heart? Why was our generation singled out? Now remember that Professor Berkowitz asked the question differently. Professor Berkowitz didn't feel that our generation was singled out. He rather said
it was part of
that it's part of a larger movement that God has basically absented himself from human history, except in an unconvincing way, but has absented himself since the beginning of time. And the few times where there were miracles, that was outside of history. Sinai and the Exodus, that was outside of history. But since then, God has absented himself because he wants to provide room for human freedom. At the same time, God has an unconvincing presence to save the Jewish people from being destroyed, but that's always hidden. And therefore, for Professor Berkowitz, Holocaust theology is not separate from regular theology. Okay, for Professor Berkowitz. Let me just finish. For Berkowitz, Holocaust theology is part and parcel of understanding all of Jewish history, that God has been absent and the reason is giving human freedom. But Professor Halivni has sympathy for that argument that God has to retract himself in order to provide human freedom, but he feels that God has intervened again and again and again and again and again when it was necessary. So why did God not intervene this time? This time again is sui generis for this book.
Berkowitz, as I remember, it says that the establishment of the state of Israel became God's is a sign of God's intervention.
The survival of the Jewish people. Yeah.
Okay, two things. The survival of the Jewish people, that's the unconvincing presence. Mm-hmm. And Berkowitz sees a return of God to history in the Six-Day War. That's true, He's not sure how to interpret it, but he hopes that it's the beginning of a full return of God. In other words, Berkowitz hopes for that full return, even though he understands and he gives us the argument of God contracting himself and restricting himself and restraining himself for human freedom. Berkowitz doesn't like human freedom. He understands what it has to be, but it's really, really difficult because the Jewish people have suffered so much from him. So he's hoping for the return of God to history. Whereas in Breaking the Tablets, he feels God has been in history overtly all the time except for our terrible, terrible lifetimes of 60 years ago.
I can't let this go. I thought that God did not intervene in the holiday of Purim.
Very good point.
Esther.
If you read the book of Esther, you see there's no mention of God there. But on the basis of other traditions, he just told us, right, we just read it, that that was divine intervention also. And if God intervened at Sinai, God intervened in Egypt, and God intervened in the book of Joshua, and at Purim, why, God, why did you not intervene in the Holocaust?
The other thing is, the question of about the Holocaust being the worst that we ever had. I mean, why is it worse than the Spanish Inquisition?
So I think you missed that part. We talked about that at the very beginning. But you could read it in the book. You have the photo step there.
Okay.
The bottom of page 32. Six lines from the bottom. I certainly have no answer to this question and must be instructed by Isaiah's words when he rebuked King Hezekiah and said, according to Talmudic tradition, why do you concern yourself with the secrets of the Merciful One? Now, it's not for us to know. Indeed, it's not. But I still long to find an appropriate metaphor to capture the singular fate of our generation who suffered so terribly. Not because of anything they did or as a result of any misdeeds of their own. It was their misfortune to have lived at a time during which cosmic adjustments had to be made between the human creature as a creature with free will and the divinity that's immanent in all parts of creation, including the domain of moral choice. And now he's about to go into his theory of cosmic collision. Something that is beyond even God's free will. Here we go. And it's not that many pages. It's only a page and a quarter. Lurianic Kabbalah. Lurianic Kabbalah means the Kabbalah of Rav Yitzchak Luria, who we call in his appellation the Ari, Ari HaKadosh, the Holy Ari, the Holy Lion. We're talking about Tzfat, going back to the 16th century,
1500.
Middle of the 1500s, the greatest period of the flourishing of Kabbalah. Lurianic Kabbalah teaches us that before the creation of humankind, God contracted himself, as it were, in order to leave space for the creation of an autonomous creature, the human being. Of course, that fits into Berkowitz's theory, right? That's the Tzimtzum, that God retracts himself to leave room for human beings and for human autonomy, responsibility, fine. But we're going to go now further with this than Berkowitz went. But God's presence in the formation of humankind caused the divine contraction itself to be contracted and thus limited, which meant that space for human freedom was also limited. Let me explain that. I'll use on the board. And according to Lurianic Kabbalah, everything is God. And then God has to make a space in the middle of him so there's room for the world. So God contracts himself to the outskirts, right? And God is all the outskirts, and in the inside there is a vacuum. And the vacuum is the place that the world will be created. Don't, of course, take this literally. It's just a metaphor to explain things we can't explain. But God created a space where there is no God, so there's room for a world and for human beings. But in order for God to make the world and human beings at that point, well, how is God going to get there? To create it there, because he's on the outside. So God has to send a beam of light to the middle to create the world and human beings. That means that God has now contracted the contraction. He's undone some of the contraction to bring himself back into the empty space. Okay? That's what he meant when he said, in the line I just read, that God's presence in the formation of humankind caused the divine contraction itself to be contracted and thus limited, which meant that space for human freedom was also limited. Because God had to be there to create human beings. So there's room for human beings, but there's still some God there. And if there's some God there, that is going to impinge upon, to a certain degree, human freedom.
But after he created man, couldn't he then withdraw from it?
Okay, let's read on. There might or might not be an answer. In order to nurture human autonomy, it was therefore necessary to readjust. I think that there's an A missing in the word. Readjust, I think it should be. No, I'm sorry. That's fine. It's necessary to readjust its tzimtzum, to restore and strengthen it, and thereby to expand the area in which humanity could exercise its free will. In other words, God went in, but God now has to re-remove himself. Which means what we've seen is that the tzimtzum is not a static situation, it's a dynamic situation. God removes himself to make room for the world, but God has to put himself back in to make the world, thus take himself out again to give the world its freedom. So there's a dynamic movement of going to and fro, says Professor Berkowitz.
So does he agree then with the God is dead movement?
No. God is to and fro.
He's taking himself out again.
But God has never, after Mount Sinai, it looks like God has never come back. If you look at the history of the Jewish people.
According to the book we're reading now, God has come back. For example, at Purim.
There's a few plagues after Sinai that God... after the Bar Kokhba revolt and the destruction of the Jewish people and the pogroms and the expulsion of the...
But the fact that the Jewish people were never totally destroyed, for Professor Livni, indicates that God has been there moving the strings of history. Again, listen to his argument.
You could argue just as well that the Jewish people survived in spite of God.
Dafna.
You're right, you can argue that.
Dafna.
You can... Dafka, you mean.
Interesting, the thought occurred to me, it's a little bit off the subject, but kind of, that anthropomorphic side to this, from the standpoint that physically we have a position of a human experience that we come up with. This whole concept of God coming in, making room for, and everything else kind of is based upon the premise that no two entities, aren't physical, but two entities can occupy the same space at the same time.
You're right. That's one of the reasons why he's calling it a metaphor.
Good. Unless you're in the New York subway during rush hour.
Okay. In order to nurture human autonomy, it was therefore necessary to readjust its tzimtzum, to restore and strengthen it, and thereby to expand the area in which humanity could exercise its free will. This readjustment was necessary because as God contracts into himself, he leaves a vacuum in his wake. That's in the middle. And since a vacuum is not self-maintaining, the divine must continually regenerate itself.
Regenerate it.
Right, so we actually have here two reasons for the dynamism involved in the restraint of God. One is because he has to insert himself to create, and then has to take himself out to give free will. But secondly is because the vacuum itself is always going to collapse, because vacuums collapse, that's what they do. So God continually has to pull himself back. And then he finds himself being pulled in by the vacuum, has to pull himself back. It is a dynamic movement, and periodically God has to readjust his position when the vacuum gets too small. This means, however, that the divine continually re-enters the vacuum, that is, against his will, because the vacuum doesn't maintain itself, reintroducing divine being into its emptiness and thus effectively gnawing away at the vacuum itself. God's intervention in history, in particular the history of Israel, is among the most important sources of this gnawing away. It's every time that God decides to intervene in history, then the vacuum becomes smaller, because God goes into the center where man is, and then afterwards God has to pull himself back to maintain the equilibrium of the vacuum. lest the divine presence devour the tzimtzum altogether and vitiate free will, the Holy One periodically regenerates the tzimtzum. Stay with me, please. Restoring it to its original source and thus enabling free will to function as before. This occurs very rarely and has no parallel in history. In other words, very, very infrequently does God have to pull back to the edges because he realizes that he got too close inside. But when it happens that God pulls back to the edges, those are the rare moments in history in which there's no divine providence. When God, as it were, excuse me for the metaphor, when God takes the world to the garage to have it recalibrated, at that moment, the world is completely vulnerable to absolute human freedom.
And absolute human freedom, according to this, will, unless God does something about it, it's going to heading to it, all kinds of calamities and destructions and violence.
Right, not necessarily, but possibly.
Because
humans aren't always bad, but sometimes they are. And then the point is that what was the Shoah? It was the confluence of two rare events in human history. One, the recalibration of Tzimtzum, which leaves the world totally open to human freedom. And secondly, at the same time happened, the ascendancy of Nazism. The worst human evil tried to express itself at the same time that God had the world at the garage, as it were, and that, he says, is how the Holocaust happened. However, when it does occur, the taking the world to be fixed, when it does occur, humanity would be brought to the summit of its moral freedom to be exercised for good or for evil. From the point at which there is only a minimum of intervention from above, until the divine has re-equalized the normal balance between humanity's bounded freedom and the absolute freedom of God. Freedom of God means freedom of God to intervene. At that point, God would have restored history to be understood, according to the Tanakh, to be its normal place. In other words, for our author, the normal world is the world of divine intervention. That's what he sees happen throughout the Tanakh, and throughout most of Jewish history. What happened in the Shoah, when there was no intervention at all, for him, that is the anomaly. And it's caused by what we've been talking about. Since God will continue to intervene in history, we should expect that it will be necessary in the course of time for the tzimtzum to be restored and adjusted once again. In other words, once God completely removed himself in order to fix the vacuum that's getting too small, what will happen afterwards is that there'll be readjustment and the vacuum will go back to its normal dimensions. And according to its normal dimensions, God will intervene when it becomes necessary.
So he's claiming that God can't multitask.
That's ridiculous. He's claiming that God is bound by this periodic servicing of the universe.
Yeah, but that means he can't do two things at one time, and that's ridiculous.
That God is bound by the laws of logic, which say that you can't be and not be at the same time. And if God is periodically not there, then he can't be there when he's not there.
So,
yes, he's saying that.
Remember what Sachs said last night.
Which is?
I will be what I will be.
Right.
Not I am what I am, but I will be what I will be. So at that point, God is at the service garage.
Okay.
So when has he intervened since Sinai?
We said earlier, he's intervened in the book of Joshua. According to the philosophy of the author, at the book of Joshua, he's intervened in the first temple period. He's intervened at Purim, right?
But since then, that was 2,500 years ago. Where has he been the last 2,500 years?
I personally sympathize with you, mm-hmm. but I just want to present what he's saying. I sympathize with you.
It's interesting that he doesn't seem to be bringing up that the Holocaust was the culmination of evils for 2,000 years. Blood libels, extermination.
Fine, but it was a sui generis expression of that. Yeah. Now, as we get to the epilogue, he's going to slightly moderate his position. So,
on the other hand, he went through the Holocaust, so who are we to criticize him?
That's certainly something he would agree
with.
Mr.
Berkowitz would say we can't.
There is history. Right. History.
We have about 7 lines left at the bottom of 33. No, it's only 5 lines. Let us hope that the free will that results from this restoration of equilibrium will be exercised for good and not as it was exercised in our generation. Those murdered in the Shoah lived, as it were, outside of normal history. Because again, for him, normal history is God would have prevented such a thing. Their lives depended on how free will would be exercised by those whose freedom was fully liberated by the renewal of Tzimtzum that took place in their days, returning the divine Tzimtzum to what it was when humanity was created. Unfortunately for their victims and for us, those who exercised this free will exercised it in the most evil of ways, while the victims remained unprotected and undefended without any intervention from above. They suffered and died, but for nothing they had done. The cause of their suffering was cosmic.
I have to think in terms of what he went through to write this thing. He was as a young person in the ghetto, in the trains to Auschwitz to see his family separated by Mengele, to his grandparents go and die, to go to the labor camps to see everybody die, to come back to Siget to find no family. You know, it's you've got to think in terms of what he went through.
100%. 100%.
This is the Kabbalistic approach. And that was the heading that we have in this part of the book. Do you have any other approach?
No.
Okay. So he is saying that this is the approach that he believes to be the correct approach.
Right.
Okay.
And he's not a Kabbalist. He's one of the greatest rationalistic Talmudic scholars he is the greatest of our time. He's forced to go to the Kabbalah because there's nothing within rational theology that will explain what happened.
When was this written?
This is just a few years ago. When exactly was this written?
Oh, that's all right, that's close enough.
Yeah, but I'll
curious.
This is just a few years ago. This is 15 years ago. We're going to read a little bit on page 35. Page 35, you have a bracket there on the bottom right-hand side. I'm beginning 3 lines above the bracket. There is no evil in history comparable to the evil power of those who exercised their free will to bring about the Shoah. They acquired this power as a consequence of the renewal of Tzimtzum, a very rare cosmic phenomenon. Despite the enigmatic character, okay, that goes on to something else. Let's go to the last paragraph. I'm just skipping 2 lines. Now we may answer the question with which we opened this discussion. What prayer uniquely characterizes prayer in the concentration camps and the forced labor camps? Remember, this is an essay written as an introduction to the printing of that machzor that was reconstituted in the camps through memory on the back of cement bags and scraps of paper. So it's page 35. So they prayed in the camps. What did they pray? That's what the essay is really about. The theology we read is just an introduction. It is the prayer that asks God to eliminate the free will of the perpetrators and to take the reins of government back into his hands. A prayer like this is the prayer recited in the Rosh Hashanah Amidah. God and God of our ancestors, rule over the world in your full glory. Maloch al kol olam kulo bichvodecha. And now he's explaining why it was so important to them to pray the Rosh Hashanah prayers in the camps. Because the meaning of the prayer is, God, come back and exercise your glory and your sovereignty and stop free will from exercising itself. The sages, as is well known, introduced only one blessing. The blessing of the day into the Sabbath and holiday Amidah, as opposed to the 12 and later 13 petitionary blessings they introduced into the daily Amidah. In addition to the three at the beginning, three at the end, there's 13 in the middle. The petitions introduced in order of sadness to the... I'm not going to read this, I'm going to read now the last paragraph on the page, where my bracket is. In the concentration camps, do you have a bracket there?
Yeah.
In the concentration camps and forced labor camps, this supplemental phrase, you know, the edition of Rosh Hashanah, reign over the world in your glory, acquired additional and decisive meanings. The prisoners perceived the incomprehensible evil that happened as the consequence of the Holy One's abdicating his rule, of his transferring the reins of government to the cruel hands of bloodsuckers, and of his own decision not to intervene against them, but to grant them unlimited authority. Against them they prayed, as the inmates prayed, rule over the world in your full glory, and may every creature know that you created it, and everything that moves know that you move it. You recognize that, I assume, from the Rosh Hashanah liturgy. And they said, now these villains behave like gods. The inmates said to themselves, these villains behave like gods. Life and death is in their hands. But by their will life is given, and by their will life is taken away. Remove this power from them and punish them according to their deeds. And then, quoting again from the Machzor, every soul will say, the Lord God of Israel is king, and his dominion, the right and true one, rules over all. That was the prayer in the camps. And that's the end of what I photostated for you. But except for what I gave out today, right?
Yes.
So now, we're going to read the epilogue. We're skipping 50 pages, and we're going to the epilogue. When he puts it all together, and I think also he moderates his position a little bit. The epilogue, we're going to page 107. Right? And everyone has the epilogue?
Yes.
Would you like?
Sure. Thank you.
Arwen, did you get one? The epilogue?
Yes, I have it. I assume it's
the... No.
Oh,
the new one that was...
Page 107.
Oh, it's a new one. It's not the one.
It's the epilogue of the book, not the epilogue of that particular article.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
Okay, here we are. Page 107. There were two major theological events in Jewish history. Revelation at Sinai and revelation at Auschwitz. In the footnote, he explains that he wrote Revelation at Auschwitz with a small r, because it's not the same thing as Revelation at Sinai with a big r, but he calls it revelation. It was an event that we have to learn something about God from. The former was a revelation of God's presence, the latter a revelation of God's absence. The former indicated God's nearness to us, the latter God's distance. At Sinai, God appeared before Israel, addressed us, and gave us instructions. At Auschwitz, God absented himself from Israel, abandoned us, and handed us over to the enemy. In between these two periods, Israel's spiritual history took place. Moving between God's embracing us at Sinai and God's withdrawing from us at Auschwitz, between divine intervention and divine abandonment, between our sense of connection and our sense of detachment. I detect here a moderation of his position, because he no longer says that everything was about Hashkacha until the Holocaust. Now he says that there was a moving between God's embrace and God's abandonment. Every aspect of spiritual life is affected by this movement of God. The way we believe, the way we pray, the way we study His Torah, and the way we make ritual decisions. The way we view His connection to us affects our place and purpose in the universe. Our catechism and our beliefs are formed by it. Prayer is certainly affected by this movement, whether we concentrate on extolling God's greatness, lamenting His inaccessibility, or pleading that He should not discard us, that He should not take away the Holy Spirit from us, that He should continue to abide among us. But how does this movement again of God, from distance to nearness and vice versa, how does it affect the study of Torah and the halachic and theological decisions that issue from this study? The purpose of this chapter is to respond to this question by narrating the gradual erosion of God's presence among us since Sinai, so that from the perspective of our relationship to God, Auschwitz appears not as a sudden eclipse of God, but as the ultimate outcome of a long process that began in the post-biblical period. That is different than what he wrote at the beginning of the book. It's different. It brings us closer to Berkowitz. It's not the same thing, but this idea of a gradual erosion brings us closer to Berkowitz. We're skipping 108, 109, 110, 111, 112, 113. We're picking up in 114. And I want to tell you guys something. A miracle is about to occur. Because we're about to do what I said we'd do, which never happens.
In one class.
It's going to do all the material I said we'd finish. And that's a miracle.
And I don't even believe in miracles, and I can understand what you're saying.
Page 114.
Well, maybe we should get into a discussion that will delay us.
No discussions in this class. We never have discussions. Page 114 in the middle, where it says, in short. Do you guys see it?
Yeah.
In short.
There's a bracket.
In short, the horrendous divine abandonment that took place during the years of the Shoah marked the pronunciation?
Nader.
Of a long, gradual process that may have already begun with the golden calf. So now he does seem to be getting even closer to the position of Berkowitz. To the bottom of the page, last two lines. We who live in the post-Auschwitz era hope and have every reason to believe that the pendulum has swung back and that God is getting closer to us. Footnote 5. Let's read footnote 5. Which brings us to the next page. Footnote 5 says, some interpret the establishment of the State of Israel as a sign of this. Okay? That's what he's talking about. Back to page 115 at the top. Yet, as far as the study... No, we don't even have to read that. I'm sorry. We read enough. Page 115 in the middle, where my bracket is. For the sake of our theology today, we need prayers like the one we recite on Rosh Hashanah. O God and God of our fathers, reign in your glory over the whole universe and be exalted above the whole earth, so that whatever has been made to know that you made it, so that whatever has been created may understand that you created it, and so that whatever has breath in its nostrils may say, the Lord of God is Israel, is King, has dominion over all. Only a prayer that pleads that God will retake the reign he forfeited for the sake of granting free will to sinful human creatures. Only a prayer that pleads for the curtailment of God's tzimtzum, the withdrawal by means of which he was able to create a finite and corruptible world. Only a prayer that acknowledges that God's purpose of creation is for us to worship him, to obey him, to be close to him. Only prayers like these may heal the terrible wound that recent history has inflicted on us and shorten the distance between the two major events in Jewish history, Sinai and Auschwitz. Amen. Mm-hmm. He ends the book with a prayer for the curtailment of the divine contraction.
Contraction and the intervention, is this a mechanical kind of,
good question. Right, when he talked about the cosmic realignment, that was mechanical. That was beyond God's will, as it were. Whereas what he's praying for now
is a response to human prayer.
Is a response to prayer. He's that's a really good question. I think he's praying not only for the mechanical readjustment that brings us back to equilibrium, but he's praying for the reduction of human freedom.
Yeah, actually for limiting human free will.
Because for someone who went through the Holocaust, it's hard to believe that anything good comes of human free will.
Yeah.
It's actually... the pessimism of this book is really breathtaking. And again, who am I to speak because I wasn't there? But the only hope for humanity is God, ultimately, is what we're hearing.
And the problem there is free will brought destruction to Jewish people, and God wasn't there in it either. So you're left with a vacuum.
You're left with a vacuum, and he prays for the elimination as far as possible of that vacuum.
It's interesting that this is above the capacity of God. This God intervening and not intervening and intervening and not intervening. This place, as if God has no control over that. And the idea that evil arose when God had contracted himself to the extent that we would have the Shoah, that tremendous amount of evil, and God had no control over bringing himself back into the vacuum at that time. It's kind of an interesting concept because it's making it sound like this mechanism exists above and transcends God.
Yeah. Almost. I completely understand what you're saying. The mechanism was applied by God, but once the mechanism is underway, God cannot act. I can drive my car wherever I want, but when I take it to the garage and it's up on the lift, at that moment, I can't drive. Now, I drove it there. I decided to bring it to the lift, but once it's up on the lift, for those few minutes, I can't drive it away. That's what he's saying.
No, I think there's a problem with the mechanical analogy, and I think you really have to go to something that that for me works just a little bit better, not much better, a little bit better, is the idea of an energy field.
Okay.
If you're an electrical engineer, if you want to say an electromagnetic field, that's fine. That sometimes contracts and expands. Mm-hmm. Because the idea, it's a black hole in the middle. Mm-hmm. But once it's set in motion, then God can't control it. Once he plugs it into the wall, he can't control it.
So God is not...
It's not like clockwork. No. It's not like a watch.
Yeah, I understand.
But if God started it and then chose to not get involved with it in order to allow free will, and then now we're saying God has no capacity to stop it because he already started that to me diminishes our idea of God's authority.
No, but if you take the idea of Tzimtzum, God initiates a withdrawal. God decides to withdraw, right, in order to create the world. But he sets up this electronic setup, this or energy setup, that kind of, because he knows that he's going to have to make readjustments, but he almost sets it up in advance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just realized, as Mo is talking, as Joe is talking, that here we have a major difference between Berkowitz and Halivni in the following sense. According to Professor Berkovitz, while the Shoah is going on, God is looking, and God is suffering, and God is saying, I could intervene, but because human freedom is a greater value than justice, I'm not going to intervene. That's Berkovitz. Whereas Halivni says no. He says God is watching, and God is suffering, and God is saying, I would intervene if I can, but at this particular moment,
yeah,
I can't.
How much more I was taught, you know, that God was all powerful, and ways where God cannot intervene is a much more.
I hear.
Just because he's off doing something else, and whatever he set in motion to make, chose not to intervene.
I hear. But if you look at it, as Jim said we should, from the point of the author going through the Holocaust. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's easier to accept the fact that God couldn't intervene.
Right.
Because why wouldn't he have?
Right.
Why would he have let these people suffer?
If you're living through that,
and
you're saying that, you know, God could have intervened and didn't.
That's Berkovitz.
Then, but I mean, if you're in the camp, then that would support my position of saying there's no God.
I understand.
You eliminate your religious belief. And
yeah, but then you go back to the teaching that we don't understand everything that God does, and we shouldn't even bother to try.
Yeah, well.
So, you know, it, and I'm not sure that I follow that philosophy 100%.
There's been some. The night that they had the program for the March of the Living with the artist, he's a second, his father was a Holocaust survivor. The guy, I don't remember his name, he's an artist. He spoke at Shari Trilla a couple of weeks ago. He's done amazing renditions regarding God and the Holocaust. But he said his father lost his religion as a result of his experience in the camps, but continued to believe in God.
Now, what does that mean?
Lost his religion, but continued to believe in God.
His struggle.
Oh.
That became his struggle that he tried to work out, and eventually he said he went to yeshivas, he didn't believe in Esther Ponim, didn't believe any of none of the theories that he heard made sense to him, and then he worked the whole thing out through God. And he uses as his analogy the Azazel,
the scapegoat,
two goats at Yom Kippur, and where he winds up, he says, "It's a good goat that gets killed, that gets sacrificed, and according to Midrash, the goat that's sent out in the wild doesn't die."
Mm-hmm.
So it's always a good guy that gets, you know, that gets sacrificed.
Well, in bringing a sacrifice to God, you're supposed to bring the best of your
No, no, but no, that, no, that's not... Sure, you bring the best to God, so you bring the best, and it's best that gets sacrificed.
Right.
I'm just quoting him, and it's the bad guy that goes free.
That's the suffering servant.
Yeah.
Right? That's the suffering servant.
Well, it could be. I don't know. I don't remember that much of what he said. But he says that analogy has worked throughout history.
I hear. And
that's how. But it's still. He's done a little bit of return to religion. But it's still, he still sees that dichotomy between religion and God.
I don't understand.
He's a Jew.
Go through the ceremony.
You said that he lost religion but still believed in God. I didn't understand.
Well, that's what he tried to explain. Were you there? No, you weren't there, Rabbi.
Yeah, I wasn't there. No, you told me about it. I heard it from you.
That's a difficult thing to wrap your head around.
Yeah.
And I can't
separate religion from God?
You mean formal religion?
He believed in God.
Right.
but he denied religion.
Is he saying that he denied the practices of a particular form of religion?
They kept kosher, they did everything, he went, but he denied religion, whatever.
See, I've heard the opposite. They denied
religion.
God and accepted religion.
No, he accepted God.
I've heard other people say. Yeah.
Everyone has a different experience.
That's one man's theory.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that I understand.
I'm not sure I understand it either.
I've had trouble with the, towards the start of Exodus, it says that God remembered his promises and commitments to the Jewish people. It took him.
Well, the way you should interpret it, perhaps, is that God deemed
watching.
At that point, God deemed at that point
he was in for a loop,
all the Jewish people were there. Was he watching?
I'm saying the way you might interpret it is that at that point, God decided it was time to do something. But again, that's a whole different can of kosher worms.
Did God enable America to develop to a world power during World War II to save the remaining Jewish people, allowing Israel to happen, allowing the thought of human rights to develop throughout the world?
I don't know. I'm just presenting.
Is this a summary or what is this?
So this handout is a summary of what we just saw and a comparison between Berkowitz and Halivni, and I didn't put into it that insight I just came to that I said 5 minutes ago, that at the time of the Shoah, according to Berkowitz, God is voluntarily deciding not to intervene for the sake of human freedom, whereas according to Halivni, God is involuntarily not intervening because he's unable.
So we start next week?
So, next week we move to my mentor and colleague and guide, Rav Yitz Greenberg, who, by the way, is going to be in Dallas the weekend of January 17th, 18th at Anshei Torah, brought by Janice Sweet. I won't be in Dallas at that point, unfortunately. Now, let me just put Rav Yitz in context. Both Halivni and Berkowitz have had at the centerpiece of their theology this idea of God contracting himself in order to provide human beings with the opportunity to be human, which means to exercise freedom and gain human responsibility. However, neither of these two thinkers were willing to fully accept the implications of that philosophy. Both of them believe that when human beings are allowed to be fully human, they eventually become fully animal. Mm-hmm. Witness the Holocaust.
Witness the Muslims now.
Okay, and therefore, both of these thinkers have to draw back from that philosophy to a certain degree, some more, some less. Professor Greenberg, Rav Yitz Greenberg, is the only one of these thinkers that is able to fully embrace the implications of his own theology of the meaning of human freedom. Rav Yitz will see a continuum in which God throughout history is providing more and more freedom. And the Shoah is a result of that freedom, but the Shoah should not and will not prevent God and prevent us from wanting to continue to grant more and more freedom. The opportunities are greater as history goes on, and the danger is greater. And we have to live with that danger. We have to know there could be another Holocaust, but there also is the possibility for greater exercise of human ethical responsibility.
And there would be another one, except for Israel has the atom bomb.
There could be an atom bomb on Israel.
This is all focused on Jews.
Mm-hmm.
What about God's relationship to Sudan or something where there's another Holocaust going on? I mean,
right?
You know,
right?
I'm not sure that I understand the connection there.
Right. Very good point. Jewish theology has been very parochial. And it's really only in our generation, I mean in this decade, that Jewish theology is breaking out of that parochialism. And I'm referring to Rav Shmuley Boteach, and I'm referring to the chief rabbi who was here last night. They are beginning to take Jewish theology out of its parochialism and its narrow focus on the Jewish people.
Yeah, most students, I think, of the Holocaust, the serious students of the Holocaust, will claim that the uniqueness of the, you know, our question is, why is it unique? Why is it so different? Is because it's certainly the first time in modern history, if not in all of history, a government was taking a position to obliterate a whole people.
What about the Armenian Holocaust?
No, they could escape. They were able to escape. And Hitler's plan was there would be no escape, that he right. would get every Jew wherever that Jew was.
But first
he also went back three generations.
At first he went.
And if he went back more generations, his DNA has showed Jewish blood.
Yeah.
They've been able to prove through yeah. family members.
See, Cambodia, there wasn't an attempt to, a lot of people died, but there wasn't an attempt to wipe out the whole people.